August 28, 1991, Houma, Louisiana. 50-year-old AJ Bro leaves an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting at the local Easy Does It Club, but never returns home. 2 days later, AJ's abandoned car is found in a park across the street from the club, with many of his possessions still inside. Over the next several weeks, there would be a number of odd developments, including multiple sightings of AJ with the group of unidentified men, and an anonymous note stating that he committed suicide after falling off the wagon. But no trace of AJ is ever found. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be delving into a baffling missing persons case, the 1991 disappearance of AJ Bro. That voice you just heard narrate our intro was Providence Auditore, the latest winner of our Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Providence. If you would like to enter this contest and potentially earn the chance to narrate our intro sometime in the future, I will be providing instructions about how to do so at the end of this episode. Anyway, today's case was once featured on Unsolved Mysteries, and I've received numerous requests to cover it. Since I'm going to be attending CrimeCon in New Orleans in 2 weeks, and I wanted to explore some Louisiana-based cold cases in preparation, I thought this would be an ideal time to finally do an episode about this one. This is the tragic story of a recovering alcoholic who had managed to stay sober for 8 years and went out of his way to help others who suffered from the same issues. By all accounts, AJ Bro was an incredibly kind and generous man, so the community was left in complete shock when he vanished without a trace. What's particularly odd about this case is that in the days following his disappearance, AJ was seen in the company of 3 unidentified men, and since these sightings were reported by people who knew AJ personally, there is good reason to believe they were credible. But who were these men? Why was AJ with them? And what ultimately happened to him? There's been speculation that AJ's work with Alcoholics Anonymous could have played a role in his disappearance, but that's just one of the angles we are going to explore on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the bizarre disappearance of AJ Bro. Our story begins in 1991 in Houma, Louisiana, a town of around 31,000 people located in Terrebonne Parish, over 50 miles southwest of New Orleans. Our central figure is 50-year-old Adam John Bro, who goes by the name AJ. AJ has lived in Houma his entire life, and has 3 adult daughters, Melissa, Monica, and Tanya. For the past 3 decades, AJ has worked as a salesman at the Earl Williams clothing store, as he first took the job in high school and loved it so much that he decided to hold on to it permanently. AJ divorced his wife Lois in 1974 and unfortunately would find himself struggling with alcoholism. Things finally reached a breaking point in 1983 when AJ was arrested for drunk driving, but this incident seemed to provide him with a wake-up call, and he sought help by joining Alcoholics Anonymous. The treatment worked so well for AJ that he managed to maintain his sobriety for the next 8 years. But AJ also wanted to use his experience to help others, and he eventually became the secretary of the local Alcoholics Anonymous chapter. Nearly every night, AJ attended a support group at the Easy Does It Club, located in an old warehouse on Bernard Street. He became a sponsor for other recovering alcoholics and went out of his way to counsel them, making himself available day or night for anyone who needed his assistance. While there was no chance of reconciliation between AJ and his ex-wife, they remained good friends. He was also very close to his three daughters and was overjoyed when Melissa gave birth to his first granddaughter. AJ also maintained a close relationship with his older sister Gloria, and when her husband passed away, AJ would take her driving to help her obtain her first license at age 60. On the evening of Friday, August the 28th, which also happened to be his sister's birthday, AJ attended another meeting at the Easy Does It Club. Later that weekend, he was scheduled to receive an award for his work at a local Alcoholics Anonymous convention. After the meeting, AJ helped clean up and was one of the last people to leave. While driving home in his 1988 Ford Tempo, AJ stopped at a local convenience store at around 10 p.m. in order to purchase a carton of milk. The cashier knew AJ personally and chatted with him, and would later say she remembered the transaction because AJ complained about how much the milk cost. But after he left the store, AJ never made it back home. At the time, he was sharing a house with his daughter Tanya, and when he failed to turn up by morning, she reported her father missing. On August the 30th, AJ's daughters received word that his Ford Tempo had been seen in Jim Bowie Park, located directly across the street from the Easy Does It Club, so they asked the police to meet them there. Sure enough, AJ's locked car was found abandoned in the park. At the time, it was raining so hard that the police had to tow the vehicle to a dry location at their headquarters before they could search it, and the heavy rainfall ensured they would be unable to collect any forensic evidence. Many of AJ's personal possessions were still inside the car, tucked underneath the front seat, including his wallet, his personal checkbook, and his checkbook for the Alcoholics Anonymous chapter. They also found a bank bag containing $165 in AA funds, which AJ was responsible for handling as the chapter secretary. The vehicle's keys were missing, and curiously, the carton of milk AJ had purchased at the convenience store right before he disappeared was not there either, and it could not be found in AJ's refrigerator. Another odd detail was the fact that the gas tank was nearly empty, even though AJ had purchased $10 worth of fuel at the same convenience store only hours before he went missing. This suggested that the car had been driven a great distance before it was abandoned. A search of Jim Bowie Park turned up no additional evidence, and since there were no signs of struggle or foul play inside AJ's vehicle, the whole situation left everyone completely baffled. However, it wouldn't be long before eyewitnesses came forward who claimed to have seen AJ alive in the days following his disappearance. On August the 30th, the same day AJ's car was found, a local resident named Kenneth Pellegrin said that he went to a convenience store in Houma and bumped into AJ talking on a payphone outside. Pellegrin had known AJ for nearly his entire life and said hi, but even though AJ was usually very friendly and outgoing, he barely acknowledged him. Pellegrin thought AJ seemed nervous and noticed that he was looking towards a red compact car parked in front of the store. According to Pellegrin, the engine was running, and there were three men inside the vehicle who appeared to be watching AJ. Pellegrin also took note of the clothing AJ was wearing, as he was dressed in a flannel shirt, loose-fitting brown pants which seemed too big for him, and old tennis shoes. This struck Pellegrin as very uncharacteristic, since AJ was usually dressed very neatly whenever he went out in public, and he had been seen wearing a white dress shirt, tie, and slacks on the night he went missing. Pellegrin went into the store, but by the time he came back outside, AJ and the red car were gone. Unfortunately, at this point, Pellegrin had not yet heard AJ was a missing person, so he did not realize the significance of what he had seen until later. Things became even more interesting when another eyewitness seemed to corroborate Pellegrin's story. This man lived on a rural route located 8 miles outside of Houma, and on August the 30th, he claimed that he saw a red compact car drive by his house, which contained AJ and three unidentified men. Like Pellegrin, this witness knew AJ personally and waved to him, but was surprised when AJ did not wave back. The sighting took on a lot more significance once the witness learned that AJ was a missing person, and that he was the second person to have seen AJ in the company of three men and a red car. If that wasn't enough, a golf course maintenance worker contacted police and reported an incident where he had seen three men forcing another man into a white car at Jim Bowie Park, the same location where AJ's Ford Tempo had been found. However, the details of this witness's story were sketchy, and it's unclear on what exact date the alleged incident took place. It was never positively confirmed if the man the worker saw was AJ, so this sighting was not given the same weight as the others. Well, 2 weeks later, the case took another disturbing turn when the Holman Police Department received an anonymous handwritten note which read, quote, AJ Bro. He was drunk at the time. Self-inflicted gunshot wound. Stomach. Drawstring cotton sack. Put in by friend. Rolled over steep grassy bayou bank. Near dam. End quote. The note was signed with the name Helene and seemed to imply that AJ had fallen off the wagon and committed suicide. Well, it turned out that AJ's car was abandoned in fairly close proximity to a body of water containing a dam, so an extensive search was performed. Both sides of the dam were dredged, but the search failed to turn up AJ's body, or any corroborating evidence to support the scenario described in the note. Police ultimately leaned towards the note being a cruel hoax, but there would soon be another eyewitness sighting, which lent credence to the possibility that AJ might have fallen off the wagon and was still alive somewhere. On September the 24th, a woman named Christy Boudreau claimed that she was sitting on her front porch in the town of Lockport, located 18 miles from Houma, when a van pulled up in front of her house. Boudreau had previously seen the van pass by multiple times and suspected the driver might be lost. An unkempt man soon climbed out and approached Boudreau and appeared to be shaking and nervous. She suspected he was homeless and could immediately smell alcohol in his breath when he spoke to her. The man was carrying a bag containing some frozen fish and asked Boudreau if she would like to buy some, but after she declined, he left and drove away. Boudreau suddenly remembered a missing poster she had recently seen at the post office for AJ Bro and came to believe the man might have been him. When she contacted the police and they showed her a photograph of AJ, she initially could not make a positive identification. But when they showed Boudreau the mugshot which had been taken of AJ when he was arrested for drunk driving in 1983, she became certain this was the same man she had seen. This caused some people to wonder if AJ might have started drinking again, which could have potentially caused him to black out and develop memory loss. If the man Boudreau saw was actually AJ, had he legitimately forgotten who he was? Well, since AJ's wallet, checkbook, and $165 in cash were left behind in his vehicle, his family did not believe he took off on his own and suspected he was abducted, possibly by the three men who were seen with him and the red compact car. Due to AJ's willingness to help anyone who sought his assistance at Alcoholics Anonymous, there was speculation that he may have attempted to help the wrong person and found his life in danger. Unfortunately, the three men were never identified, and there would be no more reported sightings of AJ. The case attained national exposure when it was featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries in November of 1992, but this failed to generate any substantial new leads. In August of 1998, on the 7th anniversary of his disappearance, AJ was declared legally dead by his family so they could handle his finances. In 2014, AJ's entire family decided to hold a memorial for him in Jim Bowie Park. In attendance were AJ's ex-wife, three daughters, and seven grandchildren, though there was a lot of sadness over the fact that AJ only got to meet one of his grandchildren, who was only 2 years old when he went missing. Everyone wore t-shirts featuring AJ's smiling face and released a bunch of balloons with his name and the date of his disappearance into the air in order to honor him. The event was called Project Wish, and there was hope that the publicity might compel someone to come forward with information. But unfortunately, AJ Bro has still never been found, and there's still no answers about what actually happened to him. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. So this is a very baffling and frustrating story of a man who pretty much met the definition of the term pillar of the community before he inexplicably went missing from said community. While he had his issues with personal demons, by all accounts, A.J. Bro was just a beloved figure in Houma who was very close to his family and friends, and considering that he lived in the town his entire life and held down the same job for over 30 years, he seemed like a very unlikely candidate to disappear voluntarily. Putting all that aside, AJ took so much pride in his work and the local Alcoholics Anonymous chapter and his devotion to help others, making himself available virtually 24 hours a day for anyone who struggled with the same issues he had and required his assistance. If you research this case online, you'll actually find quite a few comments from people who claim to have known AJ personally and have nothing but glowing things to say about him, even going so far as to credit him with helping them battle their own struggles with alcoholism. While the evidence in this case does strongly suggest that AJ was abducted and eventually became the victim of foul play, I suppose you can't completely discount the possibility that he staged his own disappearance. Given how hard AJ had worked to rebuild his reputation with 8 straight years of sobriety, if he had fallen off the wagon, could he have felt so ashamed that he decided to run away, or possibly even take his own life? Well, regardless of which theory you believe, when you try to put all the pieces of the puzzle together in this case, they just don't quite fit. But there's one more aspect of AJ's life which has never been made public until recent years. In August of 2017, a new article was published about this case in the local newspaper, the Houma Courier, and AJ's daughters revealed that their father was gay. This was a closely guarded secret which AJ never talked about, and his daughters apparently did not even find out until after he went missing. One of the main reasons AJ felt it was important to keep quiet about this was because he spent his entire life working in a clothing store and feared that men would not want to go there and be fitted by him if they knew he was gay. For this reason, investigators have explored the possibility that AJ might have been a victim of Ronald Dominique, a serial killer nicknamed the Bayou Strangler, who also happened to hail from Houma. Following his arrest in 2006, Dominique confessed to the rape and murders of at least 23 gay men over the preceding decade, many of whom were living transient lifestyles. However, police do not think AJ fit the profile of Dominique's typical victim, who were often much younger than 50 years old. Dominique's first known murder also did not take place until July of 1997, and he would have only been 17 years old at the time AJ went missing. It seems likely that Dominique has no connection to this case, but the recent revelation about AJ's sexuality does add another potential angle to his disappearance. At the very least, it does provide some potential insight into why AJ's marriage ended in divorce, as well as his struggles with alcoholism. It could not have been easy being a middle-aged gay man living in the South during the 1970s and 80s who felt he needed to keep his sexuality a secret. But many alcoholics do finally reach a breaking point when they realize they need to get help, and it sounds like it was AJ's drunk driving arrest which prompted him to turn things around. And to his credit, not only did AJ work very hard to stay sober, but he went out of his way to help others who struggled with the same issues. That's all the more impressive once you know that AJ was doing all this while remaining in the closet, but he still managed to keep everything together. We do have to explore the possibility that this is somehow connected to his disappearance. I do not think it's likely that AJ ran away and cut off all contact with his family to start a new life, but I guess the one thing which might have compelled him to take such a drastic step is if he had fallen in love with another man and decided they needed to take off without telling anyone. But it sounds like AJ was just too devoted to his family and his work with AA to do something like that. I'm sure it's also possible that AJ's disappearance could have been the result of a hate crime from someone who found out about his homosexuality, but the circumstances don't really support that. If the sightings of AJ with the three men in the red car are legitimate, then I don't see why they would take him out in public and allow him to talk on a payphone if they wanted to murder him because he was gay. But let's start at the very beginning and follow the timeline. We know that AJ went missing shortly after he finished an AA meeting at the Easy Does It Club, and the last confirmed sighting of him was when he stopped at a convenience store to purchase some milk on the way home. Yet as far as anyone can tell, AJ never made it home, and his abandoned car was found in the park across the street from the Easy Does It Club, which is in the opposite direction. So what could have happened to AJ after he left the store? I know it's a small detail, but one of the most baffling aspects of this mystery to me is the whereabouts of the carton of milk AJ purchased. It wasn't found in AJ's refrigerator at his house, nor was it inside his abandoned car, even though most of his other personal possessions were there. There's probably a simple explanation, such as that AJ was abducted while he was carrying the milk, causing him to drop it, or he went to meet someone and they drank it. I think it's very likely that AJ did cross paths with another person shortly after he left the store. It doesn't sound like the cashier saw AJ speak with anyone else while he was inside, but he could have met someone in the parking lot who either convinced him to drive somewhere or forcibly abducted him in his own vehicle. That's the thing with AJ's work as a sponsor at Alcoholics Anonymous. He promised to make himself available at any hour of the day or night for anyone in need. So even though it was around 10 p.m. and AJ was headed home, if someone told him they needed his help, he would drop everything to be there for them. If that's what happened, then I'd be interested to know how this person would have contacted AJ, since we're talking about an era where very few people had cell phones. I guess it's possible that AJ could have carried around a beeper in case anyone needed to reach him, but this has never been confirmed. However, one of the strangest aspects of this case is that the fuel tank for AJ's car was nearly empty when it was discovered in Jim Bowie Park, even though he had put $10 worth of gas in it only hours before he was last seen. Yes, $10 worth of gas doesn't seem like much today, but it would have carried you a lot farther back in 1991. So this seems to indicate that the vehicle was driven around a lot during the 2 days it was unaccounted for, but it's unknown if AJ himself would have been behind the wheel. Now, it certainly doesn't seem like robbery was the motive for what happened to AJ, and a bag containing the Alcoholics Anonymous funds were left inside the vehicle. In fact, I find it interesting that all these items, along with AJ's checkbooks, were deliberately placed underneath the front seat, though I don't know if AJ himself would have placed them there. Whatever the case, this is the biggest piece of evidence against the idea that AJ took off voluntarily. Even if he had fallen off the wagon, I don't think a recovering alcoholic would have left behind money which they would have needed to support their habit. We also know the car keys were never found, but if AJ was not the person who abandoned the vehicle, then I have to wonder if there's some significance to the fact that it was left in the park across the street from the Easy Does It Club. What complicates things a bit is the alleged sighting from the maintenance worker who said he saw three men forcing another man into a vehicle following AJ's disappearance. But unfortunately, details about this are sketchy, and I'm not even sure what day this supposedly took place, though Unsolved Mysteries presented a reenactment of this event, which occurred during the daytime. It doesn't seem like the police put much stock into the maintenance worker's story, especially when comparing it to the other eyewitness sightings in this case. If the Unsolved Mysteries reenactment is accurate, the worker saw this incident from a great distance away and could not positively identify AJ, and he also specifically mentioned a man being shoved into a white car, even though the other sightings place AJ with three men in a red car. Overall, I'm not sure this sighting has much significance, but since it took place in Jim Bowie Park, I guess it can't be discounted entirely. So let's talk about the other three eyewitness sightings in this case, which involve Kenneth Pellegrin, an unnamed friend of AJ's, and Christy Boudreaux. Personally, I put a lot more stock into the first two sightings, since they took place in or around AJ's hometown, and both witnesses knew him personally, whereas Christy Boudreaux claimed she saw him in the town of Lockport 4 weeks later. The Boudreaux sighting is just one of countless examples where an independent eyewitness had a chance encounter with a stranger and thought they recognized them as a missing person they had recently seen on a poster. Well, I'm sure I've said this on virtually every other episode of the podcast, but eyewitness identification can be notoriously unreliable, and there are so many missing persons cases in which a witness contacted police because they were so certain they saw the victim alive after they originally disappeared. But more often than not, it turns out they were mistaken, and they simply saw an entirely different person who resembled the victim. All that being said, the circumstances of Christy Boudreau's sighting are pretty unusual. It's not every day that a random stranger will park his van in front of your house and try to sell you a bag of frozen fish. Boudreau said the man reeked of alcohol and suspected he was homeless, and she was probably correct, as there's a good chance he was living out of his van, and peddling frozen fish was the only way he could make money. But could this man have been AJ? Well, since he was a recovering alcoholic, investigators could not completely discount the idea that he fell off the wagon and was now living as a transient, either because he suffered an alcohol-induced blackout and forgot who he was, or he was just too ashamed about his failure to stay sober that he skipped town. It is interesting how Boudreau only became certain the man she saw was AJ after looking at his mugshot from when he was arrested for drunk driving and he looked intoxicated and disheveled. However, here's the biggest problem with the idea of AJ being the man seen in Lockport. Where would he have gotten the van? He abandoned his car in Houma and left a bunch of cash inside, so if he left town, I don't know where or how he would have procured this van to be driving around in. And of course, if you believe Boudreau's sighting, then you would probably have to discount the other two sightings of AJ and Houma, since they suggest he was abducted and would not have been driving around on his own 4 weeks later. So overall, I am inclined to think that Boudreau was mistaken with her identification and encountered another man who was not AJ. But whoever he was, I would certainly be interested in learning the full backstory about this mysterious frozen fish guy. Anyway, now let's talk about the two sightings of AJ with the three men in the red compact car. Like I mentioned earlier, I find these particular sightings to be very credible, not only because both witnesses knew AJ personally, but because they took place on the same day approximately 8 miles apart, and each account had enough specific details for them to independently corroborate each other. Both witnesses said that the normally friendly AJ uncharacteristically ignored them when they tried to say hi, which seems to indicate that he was under duress at the time. But because these sightings took place 2 days after AJ originally went missing, and on the same day his Ford Tempo was found, this only generates a number of unanswered questions. The sighting by Kenneth Pellegrin at the convenience store is particularly odd. By his own admission, Pellegrin had known AJ since he was 7 years old, so I have little doubt that he actually did see him. But the strange part is that AJ was talking on the payphone while the three guys in the red car were seemingly watching him. If AJ had been abducted by these guys, then I would really love to know who he was talking on the phone with and why they were letting him do this in public. It's never been confirmed if police actually checked the phone records for that particular payphone. If they did, they've never released that information, but since this was 1991, it's possible they might not have even had the technology to do this at the time. As far as I can tell, no one has ever come forward to say that AJ called them on that particular date, so it's reasonable to assume that AJ was talking to someone who was involved in his disappearance. But if he was under duress, it seems pretty brazen for AJ's abductors to allow him to go out in public like that, especially in a town where he was one of the most recognized figures in the community. I mean, he was immediately recognized by one of his lifelong friends, Kenneth Pellegrin, and if Pellegrin had known AJ was a missing person at that time, things might have turned out differently. Another detail I find especially strange is how Pellegrin described AJ as wearing a flannel shirt, loose-fitting brown pants, and old tennis shoes, which did not match the clothes AJ had on at the time he went missing, and did not seem like the type of wardrobe he would have worn or owned. AJ was last seen wearing a dress shirt, tie, and slacks, and that particular clothing has never been found. Since there's no indication that AJ ever returned home and changed clothes, you can only assume this clothing belonged to the people who abducted him. But where was AJ during the two-day period between when he disappeared and when he was seen at the convenience store? Who were the three men in the car, and why hold him captive all that time before taking him out in public to make a phone call? Before I move on to theories, I should address one more odd clue in this case, and that's the handwritten note received by police, which claimed that AJ got drunk and shot himself in the stomach before a quote-unquote friend disposed of his body by placing it inside a sack and rolling it into the water somewhere. The note was signed Helene, but if AJ knew anyone by that name, or the name has any significance, nobody has ever said so. Police lean towards the note being a prank, and I am inclined to agree, though I won't discount the possibility that it was written by someone involved in AJ's disappearance, who concocted a phony suicide story to lead the investigation down the wrong path. If that was the intention, then they succeeded in a way, since law enforcement wound up spending days dredging both sides of a dam to search for AJ's body, and they found nothing. Whatever the motive for this note was, I'm pretty certain the scenario they described did not happen. I don't care how drunk you are, I cannot imagine anyone taking their own life by shooting themselves in the stomach, and even if AJ did commit suicide, I don't understand why someone else would feel the need to get rid of his body. While it is compelling to think that AJ's past struggles with alcoholism might have contributed to his disappearance, and that he committed suicide, ran off, or suffered some sort of blackout, I have my doubts that's what occurred. I know that AJ had worked very hard to stay sober for 8 straight years, and while I do acknowledge that anyone battling addiction can fall off the wagon at any time, I just think there's too much compelling evidence to suggest that AJ was abducted and ultimately became a victim of foul play. But the obvious question is, why would he be targeted? Well, considering that multiple people seem to be involved, it's easy to assume his disappearance was financially motivated, as getting money from him would be the most logical reason to keep him alive for at least 2 days. Perhaps AJ had accrued some sort of debt, possibly related to gambling or something, and the reason he was speaking on a public payphone was because he was making arrangements to acquire money in order to pay off the people who were holding him captive. But if the investigation uncovered any financial problems or irregularities in AJ's background, they never disclosed that. While AJ worked the same job at a clothing store for over 30 years, he did not actually own the business, and while it sounds like he led a comfortable, middle-class lifestyle, I don't get the impression he was wealthy. I'm just not seeing why anyone would target him for some sort of kidnapping or extortion scheme. AJ was the secretary for the Alcoholics Anonymous chapter, but I doubt that required him to handle large sums of money, as the bag found in his car only contained $165, and his abductors didn't even bother to take it. However, even though AJ's past issues with alcoholism may not have played a role in his disappearance, I'd say there's a good chance that his actual work with AA did. The theory that AJ's family has always latched onto is that he attempted to help someone in his Alcoholics Anonymous support group at the Easy Does It Club, and this person ultimately put his life in danger. AJ considered his work as an AA sponsor to be one of his proudest achievements, and it sounds like if anyone there asked for his assistance, he would not say no, regardless of who they were. He was willing to listen to whatever people wanted to share with him, but if someone told AJ something that they shouldn't have, that person might have had associates who decided that AJ knew too much. They subsequently forced the person AJ was sponsoring to lure him into a trap, which wouldn't have been too difficult, since AJ readily made himself available day and night for anyone who wanted to talk. So I think that shortly after leaving the convenience store, this person met up with AJ, or somehow contacted him to say they required his help, and when AJ obliged, he was abducted. Of course, this doesn't quite account for why they kept AJ alive for the next 2 days and let him go out in public to use a payphone, but I just have a feeling that AJ got in over his head with the wrong people, though it may have been through no fault of his own. But if AJ's disappearance was connected to his work with AA, his willingness to respect other people's privacy might be the biggest obstacle to figuring out what happened. Remember, it's called Alcoholics Anonymous for a reason, as people who attend these support groups value their confidentiality, especially when it involves sharing secrets with sponsors. If someone went to the support group and befriended AJ and told him something incriminating which potentially put his life at risk, AJ likely never shared this with anyone. The person responsible for AJ's disappearance may not have been someone he knew that well. It could be a person who only attended a handful of meetings and then stopped coming, and as a result, they never made an impression, and no one else even remembers them. Given that the investigation has failed to uncover any suspects or persons of interest, or any possible motive for someone to harm AJ, I have a feeling his disappearance is connected to a person or persons who stayed completely under the radar. If it happened because of his work with AA, then this is an incredibly sad story, because it means a genuinely good man who devoted his life to helping others wound up being abducted and murdered for that exact reason. As a result, his family have had to live without him for nearly 28 years, and his daughter's children have had to grow up without ever knowing their grandfather. AJ's sister once said that she could no longer enjoy her birthday because it happened to be the same day her brother went missing and brought back too many painful memories. If the sighting of AJ with the three men in the red car is accurate, then this means that multiple people were involved and know what happened, and the best chance of this case being solved is for someone to come forward and talk. So if you happen to have any information about the unsolved disappearance of AJ Bro, please contact the Houma Police Department at 985-873-6371. That's 985-873-6371. Anyway, another special thanks to our latest contest winner, Providence Auditore, for doing such a tremendous job at narrating our opening. If you've already entered this contest, you're automatically eligible for all of our future random drawings, so you don't have to do anything. But if you would like to enter and haven't already done so, please send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see featured on this podcast. Once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We've already produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and our most recent one covers the wrongful conviction of Johnny Lee Wilson, a case which was featured on Unsolved Mysteries. We've also implemented a new bonus reward for our patrons in Tier 3, in which I record my own audio commentary track, which you can play over classic episodes of Unsolved Mysteries. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to take a moment to thank our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Lisa F., Vanessa S., Jennifer L., Beth P., Holly, Carrie K., Kate M., and Angela. Thank you all so much for your support. You may have heard me recently announce that I'll be returning to Toronto this summer to participate in another true crime podcasting event at the Royal Cinema on the afternoon of August the 18th. In addition to myself, other podcasters who will be participating include Christy from Canadian True Crime, Jordan from the Nighttime Podcast, Nina from Already Gone, and Aaron from Generation Y. The event will include case presentations, panel discussions, an interactive Q&A, and a meet and greet. Tickets are $25 each, and you can find the link to our website to purchase them in our episode description. In addition, I will also be appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival being held at the Marriott Downtown Hotel in Chicago on July 13th. Dozens of your favorite true crime podcasters will be there, and I will be teaming up with Christy from Canadian True Crime to do a live show in which we will be discussing some Canadian cases. So to learn more information about this event and to purchase tickets, feel free to visit their website at tcpf2019.com. And like I mentioned in the intro, I will also be appearing on Podcast Row at CrimeCon, being held at the Hilton Riverside Hotel in New Orleans from June 7th until the 9th. We are only 2 weeks away from the event, so if you still want to purchase tickets and haven't already done so, we have our own personalized promo code to get 10% off the price of a standard badge. So to receive your 10% discount, please visit crimecon.com and enter the promo code COLD19. That's COLD19. I also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. Need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for another new episode of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.